in by reading the passage for us. Great. Okay. So it is Mark chapter 6, verse 53 to 7:23. When they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boats, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored that they might touch even the fringe of his garments. And as many as touched it were made well. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" And he said to them, "Well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.' You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." And he said to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, "Honor your father and your mother, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. But you say, 'If a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is korban, that is, given to God,' then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And many such things you do." And he called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of the person are what defile him. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, 'Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, whatever comes out of the person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within, and they defile a person." Well, hello once again, everyone. As David said, my name is David Binder, and I work for a church called St. Helens, and I serve as its prisons worker. It is great to be with you today. And I'm going to start by asking a question. I wonder what you think your biggest problem is. Moreover, who do you think gets to tell you what your biggest problem is, if anyone? Well, it's this issue of big problems that we're going to be thinking about today. We open our passage this afternoon to see that Jesus is a very in-demand guy. People from around the whole region are bringing their sick to him, and they're being healed. And they are being healed, notice there in verse 56, just by touching the edge of his garments. So it's like you touching the cuff of my shirt here. Mark, in his account, wants us to see that it's only Jesus who has the authority to know what's wrong with us and to do something about it. And so, as we look now at verses 1 to 13 of chapter 7, we see our story focus in on a group of people called the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees were bigwigs back in Jesus' day, the religious and social elites. They'd have carried much power and sway in society. They're the equivalent of the elites of Twitter and the well-respected radio talk show hosts of today, who act as gatekeepers on what is socially acceptable and what isn't. And they've spotted what they think is a big problem. They say the disciples are eating with defiled hands. We see that there in verse 2. Now it's important to understand what the meaning, or what the true meaning of this word defiled is. We're not talking about a little bit of mud on your trousers or a coffee stain on your shirt, but total inner uncleanliness and unacceptability to God. It's very strong stuff. And as we go on in the passage, we see that the Pharisees have devised an intricate system of apparently making themselves clean, insisting that others follow it too. Look there at verses 3 and 4. They wash their hands in their pots and their pans and whatnot. And when they see the disciples not complying with their regulations, they question Jesus as to why. But what does Jesus make of all of this? Well, he doesn't hold back. He calls them hypocrites, see verse 6. And why? Well, verses 7 through 13 explain. They claim to be the ones in the know. But actually, Jesus says they're making up their own rules and claiming that they're from God. These Pharisees are basically fraudsters of the highest order. This matters hugely. It's not just that the Pharisees are wrong, but actually that they're claiming to know what makes us clean to God, what makes us acceptable to him. Imagine being told by a doctor that you've got terminal brain cancer, but that by taking a polo mint, you'll be made completely well. You'd rightly be outraged, wouldn't you, at the doctor's negligence? And so here are the Pharisees. This then is the first reason the Pharisees can't make us clean. But there's a second reason. So let's look now at verses 14 to 23 of chapter 7. They focus, secondly, on the outside rather than what really matters, the inside. Jesus says this in verse 15. He says, plainly, there is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him. To the contrary, Jesus says, it's what comes out from within a person's heart that makes them unclean, unacceptable to God. See there verses 20 to 23. Now, when we think of the heart, we understandably think of the fleshy thing here, which pumps blood around our body. But in the Bible, it means much, much more than that. The heart is the very essence of a person. Jesus then is being very serious. We're unacceptable to God because of our core, our very essence. Look at the list there in verse 21 and 22. Have you been guilty of any of these things? I know I have. Jesus is saying that all the bad stuff we do, whether on this list or not, is symptomatic of our sick, defiled hearts. And so it's no surprise, is it, that the Pharisees are completely out of their depth. They're focusing on washing hands and pots and pans, outside things, which leave what really matters, the inside, completely untouched. Imagine being stranded on the M25 with a blown engine and you call the RIC to come and fix it. However, on arriving, they proceed to give your car a wash. Good as new, they say. Off you go. Now, your car might be lovely and shiny on the outside, but under the bonnet, it would be a complete disaster. I wonder how you're feeling at this point. Depressed? Despairing? Although not pleasant, it is how Jesus wants us to feel. We are supposed to be aware of our huge heart problem. And we're supposed to be aware that it is a problem that affects everyone. You, me, whether we've been in prison or not. None of us can say that we don't need this vital heart transplant. But gladly, Jesus has not left us here, aware of our need, but without a solution. He not only diagnoses the problem, but is the doctor that can give us a new heart, making us acceptable to God. You can read about this more in the rest of Mark's Gospel. But we must come to Jesus, have him open our eyes to the fact that he is God's King, admitting our heart problem and admitting that we've turned away from him and lived life our own way. And when we turn back to Jesus, we don't face a waggling finger or condemnation, but God's acceptance and salvation. All right, guys, thanks so much for listening. Without further ado, let's now go to the interview. Great. Let me just find my questions. Great. Okay. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. It's wonderful you can be here over Zoom, as you said, from sunny Swansea. Let's just start. Just introduce yourself a bit. Tell us, first of all, a bit about your early life. What was it like growing up? How was school, home life, etc.?
Okay, thank you, David. It's a privilege to be here, privilege to share a bit of my story with you today. Just as you share in that text, it's a reflection of my life that was lived without God and Christ coming into my life. So hopefully that will feed into that this afternoon. Yeah, a bit about me. Live in Swansea, married since 2003. I've got two daughters. I've been in Swansea since 1997. I'm originally from a place called Stoke-on-Trent, a place called Leek, a little bit north of that. We were brought up on a council estate. I'm the youngest of five children. My father was a drinker. He was always in the pub every evening. And then at the weekends, he would be in there in the afternoon and then in the evening. My mother was really dominated by my dad, never really had anything to say, very dominated. It was a two-bedroom council house. So if you can imagine that, with five children. we didn't have a lot as children. And really, it was, I describe it as a loveless environment that I was brought up in. I can never tell you that. I can remember a time when I was hugged by my dad or my mum. So that was the environment. So really, that had an impact on school education. I wasn't educated, really. I messed around in school. I wanted to be out of the classroom. I wanted to be on the sports field playing football or rugby or doing athletics. So for me, being in a classroom wasn't the place to be. So I always winged it, just got by with doing minimal, never I can never remember doing homework. So I don't know what happened in them years. So, I got to the age of 15, 16, and then that kind of teenager year, drinking, not heavily, just doing stuff at the weekend, minor troubles getting involved in, left school, no qualifications, went on what was called a YTS scheme. Don't know if anybody remembers them. I'm now 51. And I did a 2-year YTS course, went into construction. I picked it up very quickly, was very gifted in that area. I quickly went, I did a city and guilds, passed that, and went self-employed very quickly, having lots of money. But really, my life became a reflection of my dad's life. So you know what the construction industry is like, drinking, pub culture. That's what I went into. So I was working long hours, earning lots of money. And then when I wasn't at work, I was in the pub drinking. Friday nights, I'd go on the club scene in the town. And then and that's where the trouble started to kind of pick up in my life. Criminal damage of property, getting in trouble, smashing windows, fighting, knocking the balls off Pelican Crossings and kicking them down the street. They're kind of my memories. So that's where I came to, and I became bored of that. So I wanted to move on, and I started smoking cannabis. Seemed pretty innocent at that time. So I was a drinker and a cannabis smoker, did that for about a year. Came into contact with other drugs once I started to purchase cannabis. Started to see stuff like amphetamine, people injecting amphetamine, other drugs like ecstasy, methadone. And that was the stepping stone. So I started injecting amphetamine. I didn't think I would ever become an intravenous drug user. If you'd have told me that I would have done that, I would never believed you as a kid, but I did. I started using intravenously. I got hooked very quickly. I loved the high that you got from it. And I moved on then into more of the high up drugs, ecstasy, moved on to that club scene, rave clubs, weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, doing the nightclubs, rave scenes, ecstasy, and taking amphetamine. And then I started to take something called methadone, which would, as it was called, a downer, which is a substitute for heroin addicts. It's the same as heroin, really, but you don't take heroin, you take methadone, so you don't steal or get into that. I got hooked on that. To get methadone, you have to have heroin in your system. So I took heroin, went to the doctors, got a methadone script, got hooked on methadone and heroin. Then I started to deal. I'm kind of giving you the... it's a long story, but... ended up dealing and got caught with a large amount and was put in prison on remand. Was caught with 100 wraps of heroin. Don't know if you want to come in there, David, to kind of...
Yeah, no, thanks so much. Thanks so much for sharing that. So, okay, so you got caught, as I say, you got caught with 100 wraps of heroin. And then just tell us then, yeah, so I assume from that, yes, you got sent to prison. Tell us a little bit, yeah, what was life like for you in prison? Yeah, and I guess prisons are seen, I think rightly so, as very dark places, but you saw the light, as it were, didn't you? And tell us just a bit about that. How did that come about?
Yeah, I think being locked up was something I wasn't used to. And I think before that point, I was getting to the place of suicidal thoughts anyway. I couldn't cope with injecting 5 or 6 times a day. And it was at that point I felt God's hand on my life. Even though I didn't know anything about God, I wouldn't know anything about the Bible. Ended up in the police cell contemplating suicide, got caught in the act of trying to commit suicide. Went to prison, horrendous, locked up for 23 hours a day. I just couldn't cope with it. It was, locked behind a door. And then you begin to adjust, but it was sleepless nights. It was over a period of about 4 months. Physiologically, my body adjusting to not having the amount of drugs that I was used to taking. So not sleeping. And then the sleep pattern began to come back. The physiological began to change. I began to settle into prison life. I began working in prison, doing T-shirts, overlocking T-shirts. So physiologically 4 months, psychologically still wanted drugs, still looking to escape, still wanting that high, even in prison, and looking for that, whatever you could get hold of in the prison. Got to about a year in my sentence and thought, you know something, I could probably go without drugs now with what's happened being in prison. You know, in some sense, it was a good thing. I'm glad I went to prison. I thank God that I was sent to prison. And I kind of thought I could go without drugs now, but inside I didn't have anything in me that would want to not take drugs when I got out of prison. I knew that within myself. So started asking questions, the God question. Not that I didn't believe in God. I could see God in creation. I never had a problem seeing God in creation, but didn't have a personal connection or a personal relationship with him. And started to go to chapel about a year into my sentence, not really getting any answers. I couldn't work out what it was about, why people are going to chapel. So the connection wasn't there. And I was about a year and a half into my sentence, a ministry, prison ministry came into prison, just like St. Alan's have a prison ministry. Thank God for prison ministries. They came in, they were called Victory Outreach. They brought in people who'd been in prison. That was something that struck a chord with me, because they were sharing their stories and their testimonies, which I could identify with. Because at that point, when they came into the prison, I knew that my life wasn't going to change. I looked in the mirror and I said, you know something, my life isn't going to change, and I know I'm going to go back on drugs when I get out of prison. And then these people came in and they were saying, I was on drugs and Jesus changed my life. And I was like, what? What's that all about? So that was the thing that stopped me in tracks. And then I spoke to the people after, and they were saying, look, we're not interested in your crimes. We're not interested in what you've done. All you need to know is Christ, that his love for you. We love you, and there's a home if you want it. So you can come and live with us. So from that moment, I asked for a Bible. I got one here. It was about this size, a little Gideon's one. And all I did, I started at the page where to find help. And there was just like different topics. And I started to turn in there to different topics and reading different parts of the Bible. I hadn't got a clue what the Bible was about. But something struck me as I was reading it, that this was true, that what I was reading and how God was speaking through his word really struck to the core of me. And I began to get the answers through reading the Bible and the text that I kept turning to. And I also went through like a conversion experience of a presence of God that I hadn't had up until that point. I was grappling. I was struggling within myself. I had lots of questions and I wanted the answers. But inside, it was like a whisper of a voice of I'm not the same person. Something has happened. I now feel the presence of God. I'm reading the Bible and it's alive. That's what happened in the cell. And I just came to the point, I knew I was a sinner. I knew that I had this heart condition, what you were saying, David, from this, you know, this afternoon, from that text, that from my core, I was a sinner. I'd lived my life without God, and Christ was the answer. And I just automatically became a Christian in the prison cell with the Bible, God himself, and the work that he did in me. I came out of prison in 1997 and left HMP Shrewsbury in the August of that year. And I came down to sunny Wales. Went to the place called Victory Outreach, and I'm very thankful that they gave me a home, because the prison system didn't really provide me anything. My family hadn't really had an interest in me, and they offered me a home. And this home really gave me that chance to study the Bible, look at the Bible, become more confident in the Bible and the knowledge and understanding of that. That was really useful for me to have that. Whilst I was doing that, I went back to college. I did an access to social welfare. I hadn't got a clue what that was. It was to take you into higher education. They asked me to fill a UCAS form in to go to university. And I said, you off your head, there's no way I'm going to do a degree. They offered me a place to do a degree in sociology. And I graduated in 2002. I got honours degree in sociology. There, met my wife in university and in the church I was going to. We got married. And yeah, so that was prison and a little bit after prison. I don't know if you want to come in there, David.
Yeah, no, thanks so much, Stephen. That's really great to hear hear a bit more of your story there and what happened in prison. Yeah, really, really great, really encouraging. Just tell us, you talked a little bit about it just there, but you know, I know from my experience working in prisons, like there's different secular organizations that come in, there's different kind of as chaplains from different religions. I guess you kind of were exposed to that as well. Just tell us a little bit, I suppose, what is it, do you think, looking back uniquely about, you know, Christianity, the gospel, that got you, as it were, or appealed to you?
Whilst I was in prison, David, what was unique about it? Yeah, I think what was unique was the testimonies, first and foremost, that struck me was that I didn't think I could change, and these people were saying that Jesus could change you. And that struck a chord with me. One, I identified with everything that they'd gone through, brokenness, drug addiction, you know, coming from the same background. But this thing they said, Jesus could change you. And that struck a chord with me. And I thought, well, how does that work? Because I need to explore more about this Jesus. If he can change you, what, you know, I want to know more. That was the hook for me. And I would say the authenticity that I saw from the people who came in, that you could see Christ in them. You could see Christ had really changed their life. You could see this Christ was real. And that drew me to want to read the Bible. And as I read that, it was just clear that it was true. It took me a while and a lot of working out in my head, but I just knew that whatever part you were reading in that Bible, it was God revealing himself, and it was true. And that Christ was the answer to sin. He was the answer to the problem. You know, I think you started off today with what's your biggest problem? And our biggest problem is we're sinners in need of a rescue, of a savior. We're in need of Christ in our life and his Holy Spirit and his word, and allowing that to keep working in us and changing us. So I think that's what is unique that we offer, you know, to prisoners, is a Christ who's real. The word of God that speaks into their situations, into their lives, and it makes a difference. You know, I go into prisons regularly, running Christianity Explored. I oversee CM Ministries for prisons. And it's a joy to go in and allow Jesus to walk off the pages of the Gospel of Mark, like you were doing your message today. It's just allowing Jesus to speak into their lives, because their biggest need is Jesus. And what's unique is Jesus will make a difference. He can change their lives. He can put that brokenness back together.
Thanks so much. No, that's great. And just to finish, Stephen, yeah, again, you touched on it there, but there might be people here, and I'm going to flip it around. Yeah, I talked about it, the kind of the heart problem. Yeah, there might be people here, Stephen, I suppose, that are thinking, actually, yeah, I know I've got this heart problem, and I know that, yeah, I'm convicted of my sin, but I just feel, yeah, and I feel like I'm too bad to be saved, actually. I suppose, yeah, I just want to finish up. How would you encourage someone in that position?
I think a lot of the time I look first and foremost to share that the Bible, in the Bible, we read the Apostle Paul, and you're reading about the Pharisees, and he said, basically, he lived the law of God perfectly. He lived his life according to all the rules and the regulations. And yet, when he got converted, he looked back over his life and he said, I am the worst of sinners, because Christ showed him his real condition outside of living to a rule and regulation tick boxes. And when he saw Christ revealed that to him, he said, I am the worst of sinners. And when I go into prison, you know, I won't judge the prisoners, because I know, one, I've done what they've done, and two, whatever place I'm at with my walk with Jesus, I'm no better than them. So I think it's really important to look at the prisoner through the lenses. I'm in the same boat with them. I'm no better than them. And I think that's the human condition, because we are pecking order. We do live by status and job and, you know, all of that. But when we come to Jesus, it's like a little explosion where all of that disappears, and all that's left is that actually we're all the same. And Jesus is the answer to that heart problem. And you know, you will have people who think, you know, the opposite, that I'm a good person, that I don't really see my need for Christ and God. And there's a part of Mark's gospel where there's a rich ruler. He's got lots of money. He's very wealthy. He's got a lot of status. The public perception of him is he's a brilliant man. And yet when he comes to Jesus, he has one question on his heart: what must I do to be saved? And I think that's the question for everybody. As much as we live through this life, the end product is, what happens? Is there salvation? Is there heaven? Is there hell? And Jesus said to him, basically, no one is good except God. And then he said, and then he reveals that he's doing the tick box. I've done this, I've done that, I've lived this, I've lived that. And Jesus says to him, listen, if you want to be saved, go and sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and come and follow me. And he went away sad, because he couldn't break free from all them things that were holding him in his life, that was holding him back to giving his life to Jesus and following Jesus and discovering that it is through Christ that there is salvation. How must I be saved? Follow me. Follow Jesus. There's the answer. He is the truth. So thank you for letting me share, David.
No worries at all. Thank you so much for sharing. Really wonderful. Really wonderful, Stephen. Thank you. Right. We've got 5 or 6 minutes now for questions for Stephen or myself. So if you have any questions, do speak now, or you can put them in the chat and I can see them here. Whatever you feel most comfortable with. So yeah, any questions, anyone?
There's got to be some questions.
A question then, perhaps from my side, Stephen. You've described very powerfully what it looked like to be saved and to have your life turned around. What's it been like since? Not so much in what you've been able to do since, but just in your heart. You know, we've talked about that heart surgery. How have you found your heart has been different since?
I would say it's David, isn't it? I think it's been one of a slow, progressive work of Jesus in my life. So has it had its struggles? Yes. Is it hard? Yes. Is it the best thing to ever have Jesus in your life? Yes. So I think it's been a slow progressive of learning the scriptures, loving the scriptures, being called to be part of prison ministry, which was in 2008. So that was, 1997, 9 years later, I went back into the prisons, which wasn't easy to do, but I really felt God wanting me to do this. It was probably one of the hardest things to do. But I had to trust God and say, if you want me to do this, because with the prison, going back into the prisons, there's the vetting, you know, you've got to go through, you know, all of the, you know, the what's names they do, checks on you, vetting. In fact, they weren't going to let me in when I first applied to go back into prison. I had to see the governor of the prison, I had to see the security governor. But I think all the way through, David, it's been a slow, progressive growing and learning. And that has taken me to over 40 countries with Christianity Explored Ministries, which is, you have to pinch yourself, because even then I have to get visas, I have to disclose information about my past, and it gets a bit of a bore. But, yeah, and one of the prisons I go into, I actually draw keys. It's a little bit surreal sometimes, David. But I think through it all is the faithfulness of Jesus, and yet that slow, progressive growing and walking with him. And yet I still fall short. I still struggle with my sin. I still struggle with insecurity, you know. And I think that will always be the case. Of who we are as humans until we go to be with the Lord. But it's been one of a blessing, and at the same time, surrealness, but a real work of the Lord. Does that answer your question, David?
Great. I've got a question here from Callum. He's just put it on the text here. He says, for people who feel they can't open the Bible or who think they won't understand, are there suggestions to encourage people to be open-minded about reading the Bible? Now, it's a really good question, Callum. I think I would say just very quickly two or three things on that. So number one, yeah, I think we can all sometimes, and I think I did before I became a Christian, you know, the Bible can come across as this very thick, almost incomprehensible volume. But actually, you open it up and it is, I think as Stephen was saying, you know, it does make sense. And I'd say just on that, I would encourage people, I think I've been doing this, you know, start with Mark's gospel, like we've been talking about today, you know, just start at the beginning, work your way through, and just ask yourself, who does Jesus say he is? What did he come to do? And how should I respond? And a second thing, I think, yeah, I think do a course. I would encourage people to do a course. One really good one, organization that Stephen works for, Christianity Explored. That's a really good way of just introducing your people to Jesus, to the gospel. Yeah, and I think just the key concepts in the Bible, key concepts of the gospel, very approachable, very kind of... yeah, in a good place, I think, where you can ask questions as well. So, yeah, I would, those are a couple of things I would suggest, I think. Stephen, anything else to add from you there?
Yeah, I think a part of the work we're doing, we're trying to get the prisoners access to the Bible and opening the Bible. And there's so many hurdles and obstacles for them opening it. And what we're, you know, part of what we do in prison ministry is to get them over them hurdles. And the first thing we've got to do is open it. And then you've got all these questions and kind of, you know, struggles with what's in front of them. I can't read that well. I don't understand this. And we're just trying to go step by step with them and try and get them over these hurdles. And it's like you said, we just want to, let's start with Jesus. Let's start with the smallest gospel. Let's see what Jesus has to say to us. Let's try and work out who he is. Let's try and work out why he's come and what the implications for my life are that. So we're just saying, look, the gospel isn't difficult. Our minds bring so much jumble to it. Let's take the jumble away and let's just come simplicity. And let's look at these three kind of easy concepts. Well, we say they're easy because when we look at Mark's gospel, we look at something called blindness, and even the disciples were with Jesus for over a year and they still didn't get it after seeing his miracles, he and his teaching, they still didn't get it. And what it needs really ultimately is a work of God. You know, we trust God. He he's going to work at the pace he's going to work in someone's life, and at the timing, you know, would I have to go to prison to become a Christian? Yep, that was God's plan for my life. Was that really hard and painful and difficult? Yep. Does it still come back and remind me? Yep, it does. But yeah, so part of the way we're doing is we're trying to get over them hurdles as much as we can. We can only do that face to face. And when they do go away, we say, look, take Mark's gospel with you and have a go at it. You know, if you can't read, we'll try and pair you up with someone. We're just trying to encourage them as much as possible. Open it, read it, ask the questions.
Great. Thanks so much, Stephen. Time is pretty much up, but let's have one more question, I think. And it's from Kim. Thanks so much, Kim. And I'll read this. It says, and she's posted it in the chat there, I'm an alcoholic addict in recovery, and my son is going down the path of construction and drinking with his father. So thank you very much for sharing. I should keep praying for them both. Do you have any advice with how to deal with the backlash I keep getting with regards to talking about God? Or should I keep praying? Stephen, do you just want to say briefly just something on that?
Yeah, I'll tell you something. I think it's a fine balance we walk, that we talk too much about God, we push people away, and it kind of turns them off. So I think it's finding a fine balance between what do they see on us? Because one of the things that some of the guys will say, I can see something in you. And I think that's one of the witnesses, isn't it? Let your light shine before men. And I think that is by the way we speak to them, the way we talk to them, how we are around them. So I think a witness is by what God is doing in us. Allow God to do the witness through us. And then I think it's sensitively choosing the times to talk about God when you feel that prompting. So it's a fine balance between the two, I think. I hope that helps, Kim.
Great, thanks for sharing. Thanks for sharing, Stephen, that's wonderful. Right, we need to finish, but thanks so much, everyone, for joining. It's been wonderful to be here. And I think just to say, if you do have any comments or questions come up, probably the best thing is to get in contact with David or Gavin, and then they can pass on any questions or comments to Stephen and I. Good, well, thanks again, everyone, and have a lovely rest of day. Thanks so much.